Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Transhumanism, you've probably heard of it, but not everybody has. It's really based upon the idea of improving human beings by technology of some sort or other. Ultimately, the idea is to transform human beings, and hence transhumanism, to get beyond being human. Some of the examples that they have with regard to this are probably most dramatically CRISPR technology, but genetic engineering in general. It's just that CRISPR technology has finally made it something maybe a little more realistic than it ever has been before. So the idea here is not to use genetic engineering to correct genetic defects, but rather to create enhancements. That's the terminology that's typically used. So enhancements means an improvement of some sort or other. So, you know, if we splice in a couple extra intelligence genes into you or something, then you've been enhanced. It's not that we corrected a defect. We improved you in some way or other. Or if we, spliced in some genes that made you super strong or something like that, then that would be a kind of a genetic engineering idea of enhancement and hence transhumanism. Another area that they talk about using these enhancements is sort of melding human beings with technology. The one that has gotten more attention in the last year or two is putting chips in the brain because of Elon Musk's studies with regard to this. I think Musk maybe is just better at PR because actually Bill Gates beat him to it by several years of putting chips in brains. But they've been using chips for quite a while to stimulate the brain, say, of Parkinson's patients to try and help them. But that's not enhancement. Again, that's where you have a defect and you're trying to fix it. Enhancement would be stimulate your brain maybe so that now you can do better thinking in some way or other, right? Prosthetic limbs, obviously, we use again for correction, but what if we got limbs to the point where they were superior to our ordinary human limbs, which we're far from that right now, but suppose we did, then maybe we would be at the level of enhancement with regard to that. Pharmaceutical areas is another place where they look for these enhancements. So if you could get certain drugs, certain medications that, say, might improve your intelligence, something like this. On college campuses throughout the United States, a large percentage of students are using concentration drugs of various sorts, at least before they take tests or something like this. And that's actually an example of transhumanism, an example of taking medications just to improve, to go above and beyond, not to fix some sort of defect or other. And again, the terminology transhumanism means maybe if we make enough of these changes, then we can transcend being human. What we'll come up with is something that's no longer human, perhaps most notably, Ray Kurzweil has promoted the dream, for him a dream, of uploading his consciousness to a computer. I don't think it's going to happen, but that's the sort of dream that he has, is transcending human beings, becoming just a mind in a computer or something like that. Now, one of the claims I want to make tonight is that transhumanism is, in a way, the new eugenics. And some of them actually willingly adopt the term eugenics. They typically stick the word liberal in front of it. They say transhumanism is liberal eugenics. What do they mean by that? Well, they have the idea that the old eugenics, that was bad news because it was coercive. You know, we were forcing people to go through these genetic things, and obviously in the extreme with Hitler, but in various forms there was forcing involved. But the liberal eugenics is just going to offer enhancements, and people are going to take those enhancements. So there are some who will willingly adopt the term eugenics. There are others who will shy away from that word eugenics, certainly. But at least some of them are willing to. But my claim is going to be that there's a kind of intellectual affinity between transhumanism and eugenics, and not just a new liberal eugenics, but with the old eugenics as well. There's no accidental connection going on here. Really, both of them have at least seemingly good intentions, right? They're trying to create some superhuman beings in some sort or other. You see that similarity between the two of them on the face of it right at the beginning. They have good intentions, and some of the technology that they're recommending is not evil in itself, certainly, but I think there's a danger in the attitude, and ultimately some of the same attitudes that crop up in eugenics are going to crop up in transhumanism as well. So we'll be focusing a lot here on sort of what attitudes are going to play and looking at an ethical analysis of these things. So let's take a look at eugenics to begin with. It did not originate with the Nazis. It actually originated in England with Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton. It's where the terminology comes from. That's where the ideal comes from of sort of breeding to get superior human beings, at least to eliminate defective human beings in some way or the other. So it starts in England, and the place it really takes off is in the United States. So the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, we find eugenics going strong in the United States. There were several states in the 20s, 20-some states that had required sterilization laws for individuals who were considered genetically defective, right, so that they had to be sterilized. Famously, Oliver Wendell Holmes' Supreme Court decision, he states that three generations of imbeciles is enough, that imbeciles was considered to be something of a technical term, not a put-down so much as we have now, but nevertheless, the idea is this girl that they wanted to sterilize, she was one of these unintelligent people, and we don't need those around anymore. So when Hitler comes on the scene, he actually viewed the United States as providing a sort of prototype of what he wanted to do. He simply took the ideas that were being used in the United States to their logical conclusion. But in the end, of course, Hitler gave eugenics a bad name. What you find in the United States is there were several eugenics organizations before World War II. What happened after World War II? Well, they didn't go away. What they did is they changed their names. They removed the word eugenics from their name, but they continued to operate with the same basic premises. But now that Hitler had come along, he had given a bad name to eugenics, so they couldn't use that name anymore. Now, I think in eugenics, we find an essential negativity. There's a kind of positive goals that's set, so it seems all kind of very positive. We want some kind of superhuman beings in some sort or other, right? But in practice, the way it achieves its goals is in a very negative manner. Sterilizing the unfit, that's how it came about in the United States, right? Killing off defective races or defective individuals. This is still seen today, say with abortion, for instance. Killing Down syndrome baby is instances of a kind of eugenics. Iceland announced a couple years back that they had eliminated Down syndrome, as if there was some kind of great medical discovery that was made. No, all that had happened is that all the Down syndrome babies were killed in the womb, so that there were none that were then born. So there's a kind of negativity to that. In the United States, we find 80 to 90% of Down syndrome babies are aborted as well. So when you turn to transhumanism, you see the same goals, right? And again, they seem kind of positive. We want to get some kind of superhuman beings involved here. But they claim now that, well, this doesn't have to be achieved in a negative manner. We can achieve it in a positive manner. We don't have to kill off the unfit, but we can simply enhance, right? We've now reached the technology where we can, in fact, offer enhancements. In fact, what we haven't in practice, and in practice what we have is still eliminating the unfit. In vitro fertilization babies are the area where this takes place more than any other, because these babies outside the womb, before you implant them in the womb, you can do a genetic analysis and make determination that maybe some are not fit. Julian Savulescu, a Harvard professor, talks about procreative benevolence. So again, very positive terminology, benevolence. It means you select the child. We're looking at in vitro fertilization here. You select the child of those that are possible. So again, he doesn't think these are real children. They're just possible children. You select a child expected to have the best life based on available information. Again, that sounds pretty positive, but when you think about, well, what does it mean to select? Well, it means to kill off the ones that you're not having, right? Kill them out. So there's still that negativity that's found there. Now, of course, with the introduction of CRISPR technology, ultimately the hope is, well, now we're really going to get to the positive use of this sort of thing. Again, we haven't quite got there yet, but it certainly seems like it's a possibility around the corner. Now, when we look at this, I think it's important to consider. It's important to consider the idea of nature as underlying what's good, right? We cannot understand what is good apart from understanding a nature. Suppose you talk about a good or a bad knife, or a good or a bad pen, a good or a bad car. Well, you can talk about these things only by understanding what the nature of a knife is, right? A knife is something for the sake of cutting, a tool for the sake of cutting. So if you didn't understand that, you could never really understand what a good knife is. The philosopher Peter Geech talks about hygrometers and what makes a good hygrometer. Most people don't know what a hygrometer is, so they have no idea what a good hygrometer is, right? But if you know what a hygrometer is, it measures humidity in the air. If you know what a hygrometer is, well, then you can tell at least something about what a good hygrometer is. But if you have no idea what it is, if you don't know its nature, you're not going to be able to know what's good for it. So it's going to be the same thing when it comes to human beings. In order to understand what's good for us as human beings, we're going to have to understand something about what it is to be a human being. The idea here is that nature involves a kind of impulse or movement to some end. So even if you consider like the knife, right? The knife is for cutting. Well, that's a kind of function, a purpose, right? And if you don't understand a purpose, a nature of as having some purpose, you can't understand something as good. So ultimately, there's this idea that you have to start with something. You have to start with a nature before you can have anything that's good. But the transhumanists are saying, no, we're going to build the nature. We're going to make the nature, right? So in a sense, they're starting apart from any notion of good and evil. Still, ultimately, they seem to have some notion of a human nature. So you look at Kurzweil's dream of uploading his consciousness to a computer. Really, there's an idea of human nature as disembodied consciousness involved here, right? And if he didn't have that, then he couldn't conceive this uploading his consciousness to a computer as anything good, right? So ultimately, excuse me, even the transhumanists are using some notion of a human nature. So that's the first thing to keep in mind, is we've got to understand something about nature. The second thing to keep in mind is a typical distinction that's raised by those who are critical of transhumanism. That's the distinction between treatment as opposed to enhancement. So the idea here is treatment involves some kind of defect or deficiency that needs correction. So if you have an illness, you need some medication to treat it, right, to fix it. If you have a genetic defect, you could also correct that genetic defect if we had the technology to do so. So there's a supposition of some defect, and as we've just seen, if you can understand what a defect is, that's the opposite of good. That means you have some understanding of nature. What's a defective eye? Well, if you don't know that an eye has a nature of seeing, there's no way you're going to figure out what a defective eye is, right? So there's some notion of purpose or nature that underlies this idea of treatment covering some sort of defect that is there. The contrast between treatment, also sometimes called healing, is enhancement. So treatment versus enhancement. Enhancement means, no, there's no defect to start with. We're just going to create something new or improve something that's there already. And that's what I said at the beginning, right? So it's not that you've got a defective intelligence. It's that we're just going to improve it, right? There's no defect present. There is enhancement above and beyond what we have. Now, I think a lot of times we can intuitively see this distinction, although sometimes it can be difficult to spell out in detail. So take cosmetic surgery, for instance. I think we all readily can recognize the difference between somebody who is in a car accident and needs cosmetic surgery to, remove some of the scarring and things like this. There you have a defect that you're correcting. That's one thing. On the other hand, you might have cosmetic surgery just because, well, I want the perfect nose or something like that, right? There, you don't have a defect. You have simply a desire for some kind of improvement or other. Talk to a counselor who deals a lot with people who have this, body image concern. He says they're some of the most beautiful people in the world, typically. But they still have some hang-up, and they're never happy, no matter, you know, what they do to them. But that's perhaps an aside. But again, we're presupposing some notion of a nature here. So the transhumanists come along, and they kind of poo-poo this distinction, say, oh, there really isn't a difference between treatment and enhancement. It's all pretty much the same thing. And that's why what we're doing is unproblematic. Whereas those who are opposing it will say, well, using some of this technology for treatment, that's a good thing. Using it for enhancement, that's problematic, right? But the transhumanists are going to poo-poo that distinction and say, no, that's not an important distinction at all. And in fact, when we talk about nature as being important, some of the transhumanists will say, well, nature, that itself is not a good thing. Nature, they say, gives us defects as well as good things. So people are born with genetic defects, for instance. So they would say, well, that's an instance of nature giving us defects. Well, if you mean by nature, Mother Nature, sort of the sum total of all causal interactions out there in the world, then, of course, nature gives us some bad things, some defects. But what we're talking about when we talk about the good is human nature, right? Human nature might be defective, but human nature is itself a standard or a movement to a good end. It itself is not the defect, right? So we've got importance of nature, importance of treatment versus enhancement. Another thing to consider before we move on and sort of evaluate these things is a difference between natural and unnatural methods of improvement or enhancing, right? So the use of technology isn't necessarily unnatural, right? But there are some unnatural uses of technology is what I'm going to be arguing. So say you have a child and you want to improve the intelligence of your child and you're going to use technology to do it. Now, one parent says, well, I'm going to use my, stereo, my music system to play Mozart because I've read that listening to Mozart improves the intelligence of children. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But at any rate, some people make that claim that classical music improves the intelligence. So they're using technology and the goal is some kind of enhancement, okay? On the other hand, another parent, same situation, no defective child, but says, I want to improve the intelligence of my child, so I'm going to use CRISPR to splice in some intelligence genes into my child. So my claim here is that these two are dramatically different. They're both using technology, but they're dramatically different. The one is kind of natural use of technology, and the other is unnatural use of technology. Another example would be, you have your child and you want your child to grow, big and strong. And you say, well, okay, I'm going to use, healthy foods of various sorts, using some technology to develop the foods and things like this, right? Another one says, well, I'm going to give my child artificial growth hormone. As a matter of fact, this is one of the more common off-label uses of medication in the United States today, which is kind of frightening, I think. But parents will go to their doctors. Off-label use is where the doctor will give a prescription for what it was not intended for initially, right? They'll go and they'll say, I want Junior to be a little bit taller. Can I get some artificial growth hormone? Indeed, doctors prescribe artificial growth hormone. Why do you want Junior to be taller? Well, studies show that taller people tend to be higher up in corporate structures and all sorts of success ratings and so on. So it's a kind of enhancement in the end that's going on here. So this is really going on right now. I'd say it's the most common real enhancement that's being used in our day today. But my claim is, well, again, there's a dramatic difference between deciding that you're going to feed your child healthy food and injecting them with artificial growth hormone, right? It's not simply a matter of using technology. Using a treadmill is using technology, but that's not an unnatural way to increase your muscle mass, right? The idea here is that nature itself, again, human nature, has given us the means to improve ourselves, right? So if you go to school and you're learning, you're using what nature has given you, because nature has given you a mind, and by studying and things along this line, you actually can improve your mind, right? It's a kind of enhancement, but it's enhancement that's built into the way your human nature operates. Same thing with eating healthy foods. Nature has given you a way to improve yourself by eating healthy foods. So nature actually gives us ways to enhance us, and therefore these are natural. Again, if you want to build your muscle mass, then exercising is a completely natural way to do that. Taking anabolic steroids is, perhaps an unnatural way. You also have to exercise beyond that, of course, but it does increase the potential that you have, right? When it comes to reproduction, again, nature has provided us a means of giving out the goods of nature in the form of genetic material, that is, through sexual intercourse between a male and female, but artificial means, which could involve this genetic manipulation involved, are means that are divorced from nature. When it comes to something like pharmaceuticals, I think the distinction is the least clear. Exactly what's the boundary between an unnatural use of pharmaceuticals and a natural use? Again, I think intuitively we tend to think, well, yeah, taking that artificial growth hormone, that's beyond the pale, but what about drinking a cup of coffee before you take a test or something like that? Is that unnatural? Well, we'd probably be inclined to say no. So I think here, and I'm going to start talking about attitude here, I think attitude comes into play to some extent with the use of pharmaceuticals. Take something like, depression and, you know, taking antidepressant medication of some sort or other. The difference here, I think, can be a lot in attitude, because our nature has given us a means to modify our emotions, right? Our emotions are not entirely beyond our control. We can do something about it. And so something like cognitive behavioral therapy, for instance, will emphasize changing our thought patterns in order to change our emotional dispositions, right? So nature has given us the means to do that, and medications can sometimes help out with that. So if somebody's depressed, maybe take medications and go through the sort of mental exercises that might improve them. And that, I think, might be a right attitude, but there's an attitude that just says, well, all I have to do is pop the pills that I have here, and that's the solution. There, it seems like the pills are now replacing what nature has given us rather than assisting what nature has given us. And that's where I think you're moving in the direction of the unnatural. But again, that's largely a matter of attitude that's coming into play here. And that brings me to then more focus upon this idea of attitude. Talk about two different kinds of love, or one that might not quite be love, but two different kinds of parental love, one might say. One is a kind of true parental love, and the other is a kind of overbearing love. And I think we're all familiar with both of them, and I suppose most parents have a bit of both of them in them, some more one way than the other. So the true love seeks to share the good with the child, and so provides the child with opportunities for development. And the success of the child is indeed the success of the child, and not so much of the parents. It allows liberty, but within limits, and helps the child to develop his or her own potentials. Overbearing love, in contrast, seeks the good of the child, not simply for the good of the child, but for some further purpose, oftentimes so that the parents might be glorified, perhaps, right? So Junior is going to be the best tennis player in the world or something along that line, and that's really going to show off how great mom or dad is. The development is not a matter of providing the opportunities, but of forcing the development, coercing the development of the child. Success in the end seems to be less success belonging to the child as it is to the parents. And this shows up in a kind of predetermination. You are going to be a doctor when you grow up, or whatever. That sort of overbearing sort of attitude that comes into play. When the child fails, it leads to great disappointment. Now, of course, in true love, it can certainly lead to disappointment as well. But in overbearing love, that disappointment oftentimes comes with a kind of retaliation, striking back at the child for letting the parents down in some way or other. So those are two different attitudes of parental love. If we turn that back in upon ourselves, I think we can see that we can love ourselves in different ways as well. There can be a kind of self-hatred that's like an overbearing love towards oneself. You set unrealistic high ideals for yourself, and when you fail, you're very disappointed and you actually strike out in anger against yourself. I think we can see this, certainly in the old eugenics. They set up a high ideal, the perfect race or something like that, sought to eliminate those who did not live up to it, a kind of striking out at any imperfection that might arise. Similarly, with, again, a Down syndrome child, the disappointment of having a Down syndrome child one strikes out against. And again, transhumanism sets up a similar high ideal, and I think the result will be a kind of self-hatred going on here. The cosmetic surgery industry advertises, almost universally their advertisements try to make you feel bad about yourself. Why? Well, if you feel bad about yourself, maybe you'll come and we can improve you, right? So it's a kind of negativity that's built into it coming in here, right? So that's one attitude, love versus overbearing love, which can turn into a kind of self-hatred. Two other attitudes I want to look at. One is ingratitude, and the last is pride. So when we receive gifts, if we're dissatisfied with a gift, that can be a kind of ingratitude. Whereas a gift is really a sharing between the giver and the one receiving. The idea of this, well, this gift isn't good enough for me, is really saying, I just want it for myself. I don't want this sharing between us. And I think transhumanism loses sight of the idea of receiving gifts from nature. Again, that idea that nature can have something good for us. We receive the gifts of nature most properly, however, not simply as our own. This is, what I have, but as something to be shared, right? The human good is really a kind of shared good. We don't attain it individually. What Rob and I and some others were talking about, collaboration, and in the sciences, there's so much collaboration on any project involved. It's not something you can attain on your own, right? Even if in another day things may have been more individual, they're always building upon others, right? We human beings are always learning from others, right? So a sort of intellectual life as a human good is something that is a shared good. It involves giving and receiving. But if we don't want to receive, we both have ingratitude and there's a kind of pride where we don't want to receive from others. We want to be independent, right? We don't want to submit to other human beings, and we don't want to submit to nature, to receive something from nature. So in the end, I think what transhumanism does is seek an isolated good, not this shared good that's really proper to human beings. Well, the transhumanists might come back with this and say, well, what's the value of sharing an inadequate good? What we transhumanists want is a superior good. Sure, you're going to share your inadequate good, but we're going to end up with a superior good. Well, I think that attitude is precisely an attitude of ingratitude and of pride, but where we see it most of all, I think, is in this kind of overbearing love that turns into self-hatred. So think of something like low self-esteem. Low self-esteem we do not view as having a healthy self-love, but nevertheless, it does arise from self-love, and indeed a kind of excess of love. Low self-esteem, you set too high of an ideal. You think you should be superior, and you don't live up to it, of course, because it's too high of an ideal. And then you're disappointed in yourself, and that's low self-esteem. But where does it start? It starts with this setting too high of an ideal. So it starts with a kind of pride, and it ends up with a kind of overbearing love. What we have to do as human beings is to learn to accept ourselves. And I don't mean a kind of defeatism where, oh, I accept, you know, I'm just an awful person. No, we accept where we are and recognize that we can take steps to improve ourselves. That doesn't mean we're going to become great overnight, right? We take the natural steps available to us to improve ourselves, not because we hate the way we are, as if we wish to eliminate our defects, the way those cosmetic advertisements want to make us feel like we have defects that need to be eliminated. Rather, it's because we recognize that we have much growth, we have good that we have received, and we want to grow in that good that we have received. But if we have the self-hatred, in the end, we end up with a kind of self-mutilation, right? Again, this cosmetic surgery that's enhancement can be a kind of self-mutilation of what you are, right? Of course, we think of self-mutilation, of people cutting themselves and things like that, which indeed I think is another instance of this, right? So what do we need to do is to learn to accept the nature of our good, and that means accepting that it's limited. We're not going to be the perfect superhuman being, right? We're going to be limited human beings because that's what we all are, right? Even when we fully realize our potential, we're still going to be limited human beings. We are good insofar as we are parts of a greater community, because, again, that human good is a shared good. It's not an independent, isolated good. Even in our failings, we are good because we are still parts. So notice what you have here. You have the idea that you as an individual can be good even in your deficiencies, right? Why? Because you're still a part of the community. You're still sharing, you're still receiving, and that's what is most important in the good. So it's by recognizing that we are parts within a whole that we can have this kind of true love for ourselves rather than this self-hatred based upon overbearing love, that we can learn to seek the good as received and not as entirely self-created. In that way, I think we can rejoice in the small goods, but as received and shared. So the transhumanists say, oh, what's the value of this shared good if it's an inferior good? We want the superior good. Well, I would have any day the inferior shared good than the superior independent good, right? Think of, you've got everything in the world, super strength, super intelligence, wealth, and so on, but you haven't a single friend in the world. Is that the human good? No, that's not the human good. The human good is a shared good, even if it's a shared good in our limitations, right? But the transhumanists, I think, miss that. They can't see it. So when we start forgetting that and we seek our isolated accomplishment, we begin to hate our failings. Because now we're not good because we're parts. We've given up the idea that we're parts, right? The only way we can be good is by attaining more and more perfections. Once you reject this idea of sharing the good. So if you attain more and more perfections, that sounds great, but if you fail from it, as you're going to, what do you have? This overbearing love that ends up in self-hatred. We end up hating our failures, learn to hate ourselves, and ourselves, we begin to see ourselves very much as failures. Now, of course, you might succeed to some extent in your independent attempt at this self-perfection, or even if you don't succeed, you might think you do. Luan's portrayal of Richard Dawkins perhaps might fit into that picture of things. At least he thinks he does, right? He has succeeded in this self-aggrandizement, right? Really, these people who think they have succeeded, and even to some extent have succeeded, are actually cut in the exact same mold as those with low self-esteem. They have a distorted self-love rather than a properly ordered self-love. They begin to pursue their own good as an excellence, as better, independent, and not as a part. And in the end, they're going to be doomed inevitably to two kinds of dissatisfaction. First, other people will outstrip them in some areas at least, right? They aren't going to be the best of everybody. And when they see that they are outstripped, they're going to see themselves as failures. Secondly, there will be moments of lucidity where they see how limited they are, right? And in those moments of lucidity, they will be turning towards despair because what they want is this super perfection. Notice again, these people have no goodness from what they are as parts. The only good they have can come by adding on perfections one upon another. And so anytime they recognize any imperfection, it ends up in this overbearing self-hatred taking hold of them. Hence, we get Oliver Wendell Holmes' Supreme Court decision, three generations of imbeciles are enough, right? Let's look down. This person has no value as an individual in themselves. All they have are these imperfections of being imbeciles that are at work. Well, a false love of oneself becomes, in the end, a false love for other human beings. Parents begin to want super excellence for their children because they don't accept them as parts. They begin to despise their limited children and desire an ideal child rather than the child that they have. They don't love the child for what he or she is, but only for excellence that they attain. And when the child falls short of the ideal, then this child has no goodness in him or herself. When we love a friend, we don't love a list of perfections. We love the friend as someone we can share the good with. But if we love somebody only for their perfections, then in the end, we have the negative attitude that their imperfections must absolutely be removed. A child can recognize this backhanded love and learn to hate the good that is given. So we turn our attention finally to enhancements and love. What is the link I want to draw here between enhancements, transhumanist enhancements, right? Unnatural enhancements, and overbearing love? What I want to suggest is that the very act of enhancing is not itself an act of love. It's a desire for a good that is not shared in human nature. It is a desire for some excellence rather than for the person who might be made better. So that the individual is loved only insofar as he is excellent and only in the excellences that he attains. So that's what I think this act of unnatural enhancing is. Enhancement does not desire the individual for herself, but only to make her some kind of perfect being. The partial good is despised because it is received. We forget in enhancing that it is also an excellence to receive. Repeated acts of enhancing, so the first claim is just that any single act of enhancing is itself not an act of love, of true love. Repeatedly engaging in these acts of enhancing will give rise to a disposition within society by which we despise the imperfect so that Down syndrome children must be eliminated, inferior races must be purged, and imbeciles must be sterilized. Defective individuals are viewed as mistakes. when we see suffering in the world, which we do all the time, right? When we see suffering in the world, we can respond in two ways. We can aim to alleviate the suffering of those around us, or we can dream of a world without suffering. And when we take that second approach, we begin to hate the world in which we live. We begin to hate the real world. A child must be received as a gift. A child yearns for love, and instead, with enhancements, he gets only goods. He has all the things that money can buy, including exceptional intelligence and superhuman strength, perhaps. But he is alone, miserably alone, and he knows it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.